Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Brian Lynn. Later, you will hear our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
my fellow Americans, today I want to update the world on our efforts to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon.
President Donald Trump announced Tuesday that the United States is withdrawing from an international agreement aimed at limiting Iran's nuclear program. In a speech at the White House, Trump said the agreement would not keep Iran's government from developing nuclear weapons and endangering the world. The U.S. leader also said he is reestablishing the highest levels of economic sanctions on Iran. Those measures are meant to punish the country for its nuclear activities. Trump said that it was, in his words, a giant fiction that Iran only wants to develop its nuclear program for peaceful purposes. The International Atomic Energy Agency has confirmed 10 times that Iran is honoring terms of the agreement. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said his country will remain in the deal without the United States. In other news, the United States has announced new sanctions on 3 Venezuelans and 20 companies for connections to drug trafficking. Vice President Mike Pence announced the measures earlier this week. He spoke during a visit to the headquarters of the Organization of American States in Washington, D.C. In his speech, the vice president condemned the government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Pence warned that Venezuela's next election would be a fake election with a fake outcome. He called on Maduro to postpone the vote. Pence said, "Hold real elections. Give the people of Venezuela real choices, because the Venezuelan people deserve to live in democracy once again." In January, the U.S. government announced steps against 4 current or former Venezuelan officials with links to corruption or repression. The crisis in Venezuela has led thousands of people to flee the country. The International Organization for Migration says that between 2015 and 2017, the number of Venezuelan immigrants in Latin America increased from 89,000 to 900,000 people. That represents an increase of more than 900%. Many people have left because of concerns about security, crime, shortages, and inflation. This week, the Vatican announced a plan to help those Venezuelans moving overseas. The Vatican's Office to Promote Integral Human Development is working with Roman Catholic officials in 8 countries on what is being called the Bridges of Solidarity Project. The 8 countries are Ecuador, Colombia, Brazil, Peru, Paraguay, Chile, Bolivia, and Argentina. Services offered through the project include building shelters and centers for the immigrants, as well as help in finding housing and jobs for them. Vatican officials say one goal is to assist the migrants with education and health care. Another is to provide support and legal assistance to them. For the past several months, Pope Francis has expressed his growing concern for the Venezuelan people. Earlier this year, the Pope spoke about Venezuela to Catholics gathered in St. Peter's Square. He appealed for an end to violence in the country. He said, "I assure my prayers for this beloved nation and express my closeness to the families that have lost their children in the riots." The Vatican's Office for Migrants and Refugees will be making available nearly $500,000 a year. The aid is to be spread among the eight nations involved in the project.
State media reported that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Chinese President Xi Jinping have met again. They were in the northeastern Chinese city of Dalian on Monday and Tuesday. It is the second meeting between Xi and Kim in recent weeks. Both meetings have come before the expected meeting between Kim and U.S. President Donald Trump. Neither leader spoke about the upcoming meeting with Trump or about last month's meeting between Kim and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. However, Chinese state broadcaster CCTV reported Xi as saying China supports North Korea to stick to denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and supports North Korea and the U.S. in solving the peninsula issue through dialogue and consultation. Kim reportedly told Xi that North Korea has no need to possess nuclear weapons if a relevant party drops its hostile policy and security threats. He was reported as saying, "I hope to build mutual trust with the U.S. through dialogue." Trump wrote on Twitter that he planned to speak with Xi later in the day to discuss trade and North Korea. He wrote that relationships and trust are building. The Trump administration has demanded that North Korea immediately agree to denuclearization. The Kim-Xi meeting was the top news story in North Korea. The country's most famous television announcer, Lee Chun-hee, even came out of near retirement to report the event. The 20-minute report did not show any pictures or videos of the visit. It said there was a deep exchange of opinions between Kim and Xi on the changes around the Korean Peninsula.
Students from across the United States are preparing to finish their high school education in the coming weeks. Most of the students will graduate, others will not. Education experts say some of the graduates will be receiving a degree even though they did not complete all school requirements. Some school officials have been found to violate graduation policies in an effort to increase graduation rates. In January, an independent audit discovered widespread graduation policy violations in the District of Columbia Public Schools, or DCPS. It found that about 34% of Washington, D.C. public school students who graduated in 2017 had not met the district's graduation requirements. The DCPS ordered the audit after several news organizations reported on the violations. The audit said that students were permitted to pass classes at most D.C. high schools, even if they had violated attendance policies. It also reported that sometimes students received passing grades even when they had missed the majority of classwork. The audit said DCPS teachers and school leaders felt pressure from officials to pass and graduate as many students as possible. It noted the city had created a culture of breaking the rules to help struggling students get through the system. The culture was fueled by the D.C. government's aggressive graduation goals, the audit said. The findings forced officials to admit the system had major problems. Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser said she believed many teachers and administrators had tried to do the right things to help students. But she added that, unfortunately, they did the wrong things. She promised that officials had taken the audit seriously and would take steps to correct the problems identified. The DCPS recently issued a progress report ahead of the year's graduation ceremonies, set to take place in early June. The report estimated that just 46% of DCPS students were on track to graduate in 2018. The district defines on-track students as those currently passing or having passed all courses required for graduation. Mark Dinarski is an education expert at the Brookings Institution's Center on Children and Families in Washington, D.C. He has studied graduation rates and requirements for years. He says he thinks it will always be difficult to get a true picture of student progress while educators are held accountable for repeatedly reaching exact targets. Dinarski says research has proven that people and groups can become corruptible when held accountable for reaching exact number goals. This sociological principle is known as Campbell's Law. Dinarski says he thinks this idea helped create the problems in D.C. schools. Many large U.S. school districts report high school graduation rates within the 75 to 80% range. Before the DCPS problems became public, district officials had reported a 73% graduation rate. Dinarski and other experts have questioned whether any of the published graduation rates can be trusted. Another problem identified in the DCPS audit was the misuse of credit recovery programs at high schools across the district. These programs permit students to make up credit if they missed too many classes or failed a course. The students can make up the work during the school year. In many cases, this coursework can be completed online. But the audit found D.C. Public Schools students violated credit recovery program requirements in several ways. Sometimes the program was offered to students who had not failed a course and was instead used in place of usual coursework. The audit also criticized administrators for creating their own credit recovery programs that did not meet district requirements. Dynarski said there is growing evidence that these programs may not be the most effective method for teaching students about the subjects they are making up. He says the major problem that results is some students graduate without the skills they need for college or employment. Studies have also shown that such students have a much higher college dropout rate if they do go on to further study. This is because they have to work even harder to make up for lost time. Dynarski says graduating unprepared students just to reach a set target also harms the economy and society as a whole. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s during the administration of President William McKinley. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell the story of that war.
Unlike other presidents of the late 1800s, William McKinley spent much of his presidency dealing with foreign policy. The most serious problem involved Spain. Spain ruled Cuba at that time. Cuban rebels had started a fight for independence. The Spanish government promised the Cuban people equal rights and self-rule, but in the future. The rebels did not want to wait. President McKinley felt Spain should be left alone to honor its promises. He also felt responsible for protecting the lives and property of Americans in Cuba. When riots broke out in Havana, he ordered the battleship Maine to sail there. One night in early 1898, a powerful explosion sank the Maine. More than 250 American sailors died. There was some evidence the explosion was caused by an accident in the ship's fuel tanks, but many Americans blamed Spain. They demanded war to free Cuba and make it independent.
President McKinley had a difficult decision to make. He did not want war. As he told a friend, "I fought in our Civil War. I saw the dead piled up. I do not want to see that again." But McKinley also knew many Americans wanted war. If he refused to fight Spain, his Republican Party could lose popular support. So, he did not ask Congress for a declaration of war right away. He sent a message to the Spanish government instead. McKinley demanded an immediate ceasefire in Cuba. He also offered his help in ending the revolt. By the time Spain agreed to the demands, McKinley had made his decision. He asked Congress for permission to use military force to bring peace to Cuba. Congress agreed. It also demanded that Spain withdraw from Cuba and give up all claims to the island. The president signed the congressional resolution. the Spanish government immediately broke relations. On April 25, 1898, the United States declared war on Spain.
The American Navy was ready to fight. It was three times bigger than the Spanish Navy. It also was better trained. A shipbuilding program begun 15 years earlier had made the American Navy one of the strongest in the world. Its ships were made of steel and carried powerful guns. Part of the American Navy at that time was based in Hong Kong. The rest was based on the Atlantic coast of the United States. Admiral George Dewey commanded the Pacific Fleet. Dewey had received a message from the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Theodore Roosevelt. If war broke out, it said, he was to attack the Spanish naval force in the Philippines. The Spanish force was commanded by Admiral Patricio Montojo.
The American fleet arrived in Manila Bay on May 1st. It sailed toward the line of Spanish ships. The Spanish fired first. The shells missed. When the two naval forces were 5,000 meters apart, Admiral Dewey ordered the Americans to fire. After 3 hours, Admiral Montojo surrendered. Most of his ships were sunk. 400 of his men were dead or wounded. American land forces arrived several weeks later. They captured Manila, giving the United States control of the Philippines.
Dewey was suddenly a hero. Songs and poems were written about him. Congress gave him special honors. A spirit of victory spread across the nation. People called for an immediate invasion of Cuba. Unlike the Navy, America's army was not ready to fight. When war was declared, the army had only about 25,000 men. Within a few months, however, it had more than 200,000. The soldiers trained at camps in the southern United States. One of the largest camps was in Florida. Cuba is just 150 kilometers off the coast of Florida.
2 weeks after the Spanish-American War began, the Army sent a small force to Cuba. The force was ordered to inspect the north coast of Cuba and to take supplies to Cuban rebels. That invasion failed, but the second one succeeded. 400 American soldiers landed with guns, bullets, and supplies for the rebels. Next, the army planned to send 25,000 men to Cuba. Their goal was the port of Santiago on the south coast. American ships had trapped a Spanish naval force there earlier. One of the commanders of the big American invasion force was Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt had resigned as Assistant Secretary of the Navy when the war started. He organized a group of horse soldiers. Most of the men were cowboys from America's Southwest. They could ride and shoot well. Some were rich young men from New York who simply shared Roosevelt's love of excitement. The group became known as Roosevelt's Rough Riders.
As the Americans landed near Santiago, Spanish forces withdrew to positions outside the city. The strongest force was at San Juan Hill. The Spanish soldiers used smokeless gunpowder. This made their artillery hard to find. The Americans did not have the smokeless powder, but they had Gatling machine guns, which poured a stream of bullets at the enemy. When the machine guns opened fire, American soldiers began moving up San Juan Hill. Several American reporters watched. Later, one of them wrote this report. "I have seen many pictures of the charge on San Juan Hill, but none seem to show it as I remember it. In the pictures, the men are running up the hill quickly in straight lines. There seem to be so many men that no enemy could stand against them." "In fact," said the reporter, "there were not many men, and they moved up the hill slowly, in a close group, not in a straight line. It seemed as if someone had made a terrible mistake. One wanted to call to these few soldiers to come back."
The American soldiers were not called back. They reached the top of San Juan Hill. The Spanish soldiers fled. "All we have to do," an American officer said, "is hold on to the hill, and Santiago will be ours." American Commander General William Shafter sent a message to Spanish Commander General José Toral. Shafter demanded Toral's surrender. While he waited for an answer, the Spanish naval force tried to break out of Santiago Harbor. The attempt failed, and the Americans took control of the port. The loss destroyed any hope that Spain could win the war. There was now no way it could send more soldiers and supplies to Cuba. General Toral agreed to a short ceasefire so women and children could leave Santiago. But he rejected General Shafter's demand of unconditional surrender. American artillery then attacked Santiago. General Toral defended the city as best he could. Finally, on July 17th, he surrendered. The United States promised to send all his soldiers back to Spain.
In the next few weeks, American forces occupied Puerto Rico and the Philippine capital of Manila. America's war with Spain was over. It had lasted just 10 weeks. The next step was to negotiate terms of a peace treaty. The negotiations would be held in Paris. The victorious United States demanded independence for Cuba. It demanded control over Puerto Rico and Guam, and it demanded the right to occupy Manila. The two sides agreed quickly on the terms concerning Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Guam, but they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. Spain rejected the American demand for control. It did not want to give up this important colony. Negotiations on this point of the peace treaty lasted for days.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.